Now, coming up, this is Your Brain on Politics. The creators of FactCheck.org tell you how not to get spun. But first, more questions today about the case of Andrew Speaker, the 31-year-old Atlanta man who sparked a health scare when he traveled with a drug-resistant form of tuberculosis. Congress is holding hearings on the case today and heard from federal officials and by phone from Speaker. Speaker is now quarantined in a Denver hospital receiving treatment. At today's hearing, there were questions about the timeline in this case, who knew what when. Speaker told lawmakers he's been unfairly painted as being irresponsible in the case.
Everyone knew I was going. I didn't go running off or hide from people. It's complete fallacy, and it's a lie.
Matthew Berger is Homeland Security correspondent for Congressional Quarterly. He's covering today's hearings and stepped out for a minute to speak to us on his cell phone. Matthew, what else did Mr. Speaker have to say?
Mr. Speaker said that CDC officials, federal officials, knew about his case a week earlier than Dr. Gerberding, the head of the CDC, seemed to imply. Now, there's some confusion because Dr. Cooksey, the father-in-law, the to-be father-in-law of the patient, Andrew Speaker, was being consulted throughout the time, but Andrew Speaker says that other CDC officials knew about his case and were even testing his samples a week before they claimed to first find out about it.
Right, and you mentioned Dr. Robert Cooksey. He's a TB specialist at the CDC. Again, he was about to become the father-in-law, and he was being consulted as well. By the way, you mentioned Dr. Gerberding. She's head of the Centers for Disease Control, addressing the issue of the father-in-law. She was asked whether or not he shares any responsibility. Did she shed any light on that?
She said that the father-in-law was in a very confusing situation, that he was an expert in this type of virus, and at the same time, he was a family member of the patient. It seemed that there was some confusion as to which was paramount and what role he should or could have played in smoothing the situation over.
More questions there. Well, Dr. Gerberding, as we said, head of CDC, said public health officials should have been more aggressive in Andrew Speaker's case, but she also said this was an unusual case.
The whole history of quarantine has been devoted to keeping people out. And containing them. And it is the first time that we've really had to address keeping people in our country.
And as far as Andrew Speaker traveling home from Italy, Dr. Gerberding said they tried to get him home, but they had issues. What were those issues?
Well, essentially that there was problems getting an aircraft that had the isolation capacity that would also be utilized in time. You had military aircraft, but there were questions as to their readiness. There were CDC planes, but those planes didn't have the isolation capacity. And there were air ambulances, but there were questions about whether the federal government would pay for those air ambulances or whether Mr. Speaker's insurance should pay for it.
And then, of course, when Speaker was told he couldn't come back in, and despite his being on a watch list that popped up on a computer at the border of the U.S. and Canada, a border guard in New York allowed him in because the guard said that Speaker looked healthy. What did Homeland Security officials say about that?
The Deputy Commissioner of the Customs and Border Protection basically took responsibility for it and said that they had him on a list. They said the list said that if you came into contact with Mr. Speaker, you were to put him in isolation, but that those orders weren't followed, and they seemed to be very embarrassed by the situation and said that this was a black mark on their record.
We should say the system, as you said, had been changed to remove that discretion for guards, but emphasize that. But all in all, in the few seconds we have, how are lawmakers receiving all of this?
They're angry. They don't understand what happened. There seem to be several missteps. And this raises a lot of questions. You know, if this was a pandemic flu or if this was another type of virus that is more easily contagious, there's real questions about stopping it at its start as opposed to it becoming a bigger problem. If I have a second, there's one thing that I should point out.
Real quick.
This is a real strange case because most people, as Dr. Gerberding has said, follow doctor's orders. And this was a good test case for the pandemic because you had someone who
didn't.
Yes.
Matthew Berger, Homeland Security correspondent for Congressional Quarterly. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, later today, we're going to have reaction to this week's debates in New Hampshire. But first, speaking of which, Politicians do it. Advertisers do it. Maybe you do it if you're trying to make a point and you conveniently leave out a competing point of view. It's called spin, and it's a polite term for deception, so writes our next guest in a book co-authored with Kathleen Hall Jamieson. The book is titled Unspun: Finding Facts in the World of Disinformation. It's from the same people who founded the website factcheck.org, one of Time Magazine's 25 websites you can't live without. And co-author Brooks Jackson joins us now from the studios of NPR in Washington. Welcome back to Here Now, Brooks.
Thank you, Robin.
We speak to you a lot when we're hot on the campaign trail, and there's a lot of fun here, a lot of political fun, a lot of resources for checking facts. But as you write, spinning can also be life or death, so we want to cut to the chase. You write that historically, Americans have been spun into war. Are you saying that the architects of the most recent war in Iraq were spinning, lying about WMDs, about Saddam Hussein's alleged and then disproved association with Osama bin Laden?
Lying, I don't know, because I can't read Dick Cheney's mind, George Bush's mind, or anybody's mind, so I don't know what they believed. We do know that some facts were presented selectively. We also know that our Central Intelligence Agency and our entire intelligence community believed, as a which they published in a national intelligence estimate, that Saddam did have weapons of mass destruction, meaning chemicals, germ weapons, stockpiles of them, and a program to develop nuclear weapons, all of which turned out to be untrue. So our CIA and the intelligence community was spun into believing, probably by Saddam Hussein, who wanted his next-door neighbors in Iran to believe that he had a nuclear program and weapons of mass destruction. And they probably fell into one of the psychological traps we talk about here, because they'd been, in the previous Gulf War, had been predicting that Saddam was nowhere close to having nuclear weapons, and found to their astonishment after the war that he was very close. Well, they weren't going to make that mistake again, and they didn't make that mistake again. They made another mistake. But historically, you can go back to the Spanish-American War. We went to war with the battle cry, "Remember the Maine," on our lips as a nation. Generations later discovered that in all probability it was the battleship Maine was sunk by an accident, smoldering coal fire next to a powder magazine.
So in other words, it wasn't that the Spanish sunk the USS Maine, which led to the Spanish-American War. You also write in 1964, when Johnson attacked North Vietnam, based on a belief that the USS Maddox and Turner Joy had been attacked, those ships hadn't been. But then you also write that if, in fact, this invasion of Iraq most recently was based on mis or disinformation, it wouldn't be the first time. You tell the story of the U.S. entry into the Kuwait-Iraq war after Iraq invaded. You tell the story of a 15-year-old girl who testified before Congress. Tell us more about that.
I'll not attempt to pronounce her name because I'll get it wrong. But she appeared, giving first name only, before a congressional committee, televised, and told this horrible story about how invading Iraqi soldiers had tossed premature infants out of their incubators and onto the floor of the hospital where she was working as a volunteer in order to take the incubators off as booty to Saddam's Iraq, leaving the infants to die.
How
well, it turns out later that was simply not true, and not supported by any of the other hospital staff who were there. And it also turns out that the woman was, in fact, a relative of the ambassador from Kuwait. This was not told to the public at the time. And the whole story had been spun by a Washington Public Relations Agency in the employ of Kuwait.
Right. She had been, as you write, fobbed off on the Human Rights Caucus in Congress, which was appalled by the story, by Hill and Knowlton, a public relations firm paid by Kuwait to whip up anti-Iraq war fever.
In all probability, my personal opinion is, the United States would have gone to war against Iraq in that instance. In any case, Saddam had invaded a neighboring country, but this certainly added to the war fever, and it shows how in time of war, when we are, our emotions are running high, and especially our fear emotion, that we sometimes, as a human beings, just take leave of our senses and are willing to believe things that on more sober examination turn out not to be true. And so the message here, I think, anytime that war fever is running high. It's a good thing for all of us, from the ordinary voters right up to presidents, to stop and take a deep breath and say, what is the real evidence here? What do I really know for sure?
Well, how much of a factor in that willingness to believe is what you call our brains on politics? And again, putting aside the invasion of Iraq, the post-9/11 fervor, just in general, you cite a fascinating study from an Emory University psychologist, Drew Weston. He did the study during the 2004 presidential campaign. What happened?
He took a group of intense John Kerry partisans and another group that was leaning strongly to George Bush, and they agreed to take part in a psychological experiment and to undergo brain scans while being interviewed. And they gave them hypothetical stories about their candidate. And the first story basically was, your candidate has just said something really stupid that's going to lose him votes. And they got their reaction to that. And then they would tell them, well, wait a minute, new information has come in that shows your candidate may not have shot both feet off. After all, there's some exculpatory information here, and maybe it's not so bad. What they found was, in the words of the author, that in processing this information in the brains of the partisans who are listening to it, I believe the exact quote was, the areas normally associated with rational thought did not come into play. It was like brain scans of drug addicts. The mind had been altered, and the partisans were at first reacting with fear and sort of a fight or flight reaction when hearing a threatening statement, a statement that would threaten their favorite candidate, and then pleasure, relief, when the candidate was allowed to wriggle off the hook.
Yeah.
And rational thought, again, just did not come into play. And that's a vulnerability we all have, that we don't always kick in the rational parts of our mind when we should.
They write, essentially, it appears as if partisans twirl the cognitive kaleidoscope until they get the conclusions they want, and then they get massively reinforced for it. When they hear the thing they want, their brain just lights up like an addict who's had its fix.
And, you know, to me, that just explains the reactions that I frequently encounter among partisans, both on the right, the left, and whatever other flavor of politics you want to name.
Well, let's go through some of them, because you're right. There's the I know I'm right trap. This came out in a piece of research from the year 2000 from political psychologist James Kuklinski. He did a phone survey of 1,600 Illinois residents asking about the welfare system there. Sum up that research.
What he found was, first of all, what you'd expect, that only about 3% of the people interviewed really knew very much about the welfare system and got more than half the questions right. But what should be a warning sign to us all is that those people holding the least accurate beliefs were the ones who expressed the highest confidence in their beliefs. So it's, you know, the wronger you are, the righter you think you are.
Right. That's Brooke Jackson of the website factcheck.org and the new book, Unspun, about getting yourself unspun. When we come back, we'll learn how you can spot politicians' tricks like the dangling comparative. And later, a reporter follows independent voters in one New Hampshire town through to the end of the primaries. We'll get their opinions on this week's debates. Are they getting spun? Back after a minute break here and now. During the last presidential campaign, you might remember, we called the folks at factcheck.org on a regular basis. Brooks Jackson runs the website that separates fact from fiction, and with Kathleen Hall Jamieson, he's co-author of the new book, Unspun, Finding Facts in a World of Disinformation. And Brooks, let's continue. You write about some of the techniques that politicians and their handlers use when they're spinning. Let's look at some of those. The dangling comparative.
Anytime you hear somebody talking about higher taxes or a cut in spending or any sort of comparative like that, you got to ask yourself, well, higher than what?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, a cut compared to what? A classic case here was from 2004. George Bush accused John Kerry of voting for higher taxes 350 times. Turns out most of those votes, the vast majority of those votes, were actually votes to keep taxes the same. They were votes against proposed tax cuts, therefore a vote to keep to have taxes higher than some Republican wanted them, but not higher than people were paying now. Democrats do the same thing, of course, when they accuse Republicans of wanting to cut spending, when actually, if you look at it, what they're quite often proposing is to slow down a rather rapid growth of spending in a particular area.
You also talk about superlative swindles. We've got two here, all right? The Republicans claim that Bill Clinton's 1993 deficit reduction bill was the biggest tax increase in American history.
And, of course, it wasn't, except in terms of just inflated dollars. If you take no account of population growth, inflation, the reduced buying power of the dollar, the growth of the economy, you can make the case that it was more dollars. But in comparison to, let's say, the 70% increase in federal revenues that came about as a result of the of Roosevelt's tax increases to finance World War II, it was a rather piddling tax increase.
The Sierra Club said that President Bush had the worst environmental record in U.S. history.
The worst record, right. Well, I seem to recall, maybe I'm dating myself, that the Cuyahoga River was once in flames, and that was in a different administration. Worst record how? Or actually, if you look at the facts, the atmosphere by EPA measurements, consistent over several administrations, has continued to get cleaner. Anytime you hear somebody say, you know, best in history, worst ever, highest, lowest, if it's a superlative, chances are it's wrong. That's just been our experience.
You talk about the misuse of data in the service of ideology, and you point to someone on the left, author Naomi Wolf, who claimed in her book, The Beauty Myth, that 150,000 women died annually from anorexia nervosa.
That's right. And that figure was accepted uncritically for a time, but it was a preposterously high number. If you had actually checked the record, that was five times more than the number of Americans who had died of AIDS that year. Now, later, another author from the right came in and said, no, no, it's not 150,000 women who die from anorexia nervosa. It's only 100. And that was rather low. A more credible estimate puts it at about 1,000 deaths per year. It's a serious problem, but it's to say that 150,000 deaths a year, that's a story that is just, as you said at the outset, data in the service of ideology. Somebody
right.
trying to make a point and not very fussy about the accuracy of the information that they're putting out.
Well, you give us the factcheck.org's guide to testing evidence, and it's terrific. You know, you consider, is the source highly regarded? Is the source an advocate? What's the track record? What method was used to find the information? And this is how you test information. Is a sample random? Is there a control group? You also mention online sites that, you know, blogs, government resources, other fact checkers, Snopes.com comes to mind, other websites where people are checking facts. If you don't mind, we'll put some of these on our website, including your website. But what's the bottom line, Brooks? What can we do, especially as we go into another, you know, big campaign season? What are some of the biggest things that people can do to make sure they're open to seeing if they're spun?
That's the key thing, is to you really have to work as a human. And it doesn't matter how smart you are. If you're not going to be spun, you really, every once in a while, have to step aside and say, all right, I know what I have gone in here believing, but I should listen to the other side just for a minute. Maybe they've got a point here that I'm missing, and examine the evidence. And maybe you're right. Maybe you won't have to change your mind. But unless you do that, unless you actively work, what we call active open-mindedness, work at keeping an open mind, you're going to be spun.
Your final rule is be skeptical but not cynical.
And as a journalist and a former investigative reporter, I get accused of being cynical all the time, and I always deny it because I don't want to be cynical. I think, to me, cynicism is automatically assuming that whatever you're told is wrong, that whoever in authority is speaking is not telling you the truth.
And as you write, cynicism is a form of gullibility because you may not get the real information.
Well, absolutely. And there is on television right now, still doing, last time I looked, infomercials and peddling a book that this is the true weight loss secret that the government doesn't want you to know about. Well, this is a fellow who was fellow with a criminal record, I should add, who was shut down by the Federal Trade Commission. from selling various products and making all sorts of false claims that he'd been making. But what they can't stop him from doing is selling a book.
This is Kevin Trudeau. He's author of the New York Times bestseller, Natural Cures They Don't Want You to Know About.
They? Who's they? Well, you see, he's preying on our cynicism. If the government doesn't want you to know about it, it must be true, right? So he's selling this hokum to people based on their own cynicism.
And so a cynic can ultimately be more gullible.
As gullible, I would say, yes. And that's I think that's a point we're thinking about.
Whereas a skeptic just wants some evidence.
Exactly.
Brooks Jackson, he runs the website factcheck.org for the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. He's co-author with Kathleen Hall Jamieson of the new book, Unspun, Finding Facts in a World of Disinformation. And Brooks, we'll see you over the course of the next couple of years of a campaign.
I look forward to it, Robin.
Tomorrow in Here and Now, was sarin gas the Agent Orange of the 1991 Gulf War? A new study says exposure to that nerve gas may have damaged the brains of Gulf War vets. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, why therapists are appalled at the recent Sopranos episode. Back after the news, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from
now. Thunder, lightning, and bush bashing, they were all on tap at the Republican presidential primary debate in Manchester, New Hampshire last night. 10 Republican presidential hopefuls faced off on issues like immigration, abortion, the war in Iraq, evolution. The candidates heaped criticism on President Bush. Here's Senator John McCain talking about the war in Iraq.
I'm going to give you a little straight talk. This war was very badly mismanaged for a long time. And Americans have made great sacrifices, some of which were unnecessary because of this management of the war, mismanagement of this conflict.
Well, during the primary season, reporter John Greenberg of New Hampshire Public Radio is focusing on one town, Exeter, New Hampshire. On Sunday, he watched the Democrats debate with some undecided Democrats. Last night, John watched the debate with three undecided Republicans, and he joins us now. And before we get to some of the issues, John, why Exeter? Who are these people?
Well, they're pretty average people, I would say. I mean, Exeter is a really good place to watch the primary because politically it's divided equally about one-third, one-third, one-third in terms of party affiliation, Democrats, Republicans, and independents. It's got a good income spread there as well. So for me, I mean, I just had a choice between following the same set of candidates around, and I know there are a lot of them, but can you imagine following the candidates around or talking to real people? Which one would you choose?
Right.
So I chose following Exeter.
And it might be easier to herd the people of Exeter, although I could just hear them saying, we're not average, we're above average. Well, the most entertaining part of the debate seemed to be the, you know, the thunder and lightning. There was a storm in, up above us in New Hampshire. We're down in Massachusetts. And it interfered with the microphones just as Rudy Giuliani was asked to respond to a criticism of his pro-choice stand from a Catholic bishop.
A Catholic bishop, any religion, you know,
that's the lightning that's having an effect on our system.
For someone who went to parochial schools all his life, this is a very frightening thing that's happening right now.
It really was quite funny, John, but a serious question. So how'd your voters react to his response?
Well, you know, two of the three voters that I was sitting with in the living room in a house in Exeter, they are just firmly pro-choice. It's not an uncommon position in New Hampshire. People, obviously, who know the state know that. I was with Jay and Laurie Kelly, and that was their house, their living room. We were with a third person, Marie Warlick, and Marie is, of the three, she is certainly accepting of early-term abortion, a little more, you know, softer around the edges in terms of open to restrictions and so forth. But the main thing here is that none of them were particularly responsive to the social issues that
came up.
That's
not what got them. Yeah. Well, let's move to John McCain because he'd been said to be foundering before last night's debate. But it seems as if your voters responded to him. You mentioned Jay Kelly, and I think he was the one who had a reaction.
Well, yes, he did. I mean, the thing about Jay is the context here. He is so frustrated by Washington. You know, what he's looking for is a leader, someone who can get around partisan fighting and make things happen. He likes pragmatic people. And when it comes to immigration, he said McCain shows that he knows how to work with other people and get things done.
He has crossed the aisle. He's worked with Kennedy. I don't particularly care for Kennedy. He's an idiot. But he has reached out. He's led an effort that resulted in a compromise that got something done.
You know, immigration is very much front of mind for Republicans up here, that, you know, they focus on the services that illegal immigrants use and the pure and simple fact that these people broke the law. And, you know, this small group of voters I was with were really split. Jay and Laurie were being very pragmatic. But for Marie, it really did stick in her throat to say that people who broke the law will somehow get what they wanted, even with fines and all the rest.
Right. And waiting a long time. But it's just interesting to hear somebody, you know, call someone an idiot in the other party, but then commend both Kennedy and McCain for coming up with at least a compromise. So that was interesting to hear that dichotomy there. Talking about Iraq, which seems to be the big topic, most of the candidates last night supported the surge, but seem to be more critical of the way the president has managed the war than I feel I've ever heard them before. And I know you, Lori Kelly, I think, had something to say about that. Why don't you set that up?
Well, you know, the thing is that all the candidates know that Republicans are really uneasy about the war. And Lori was the person who was most in that mode. She really questions whether America has the ability to shape events on the ground in Iraq. I thought it was interesting that when she heard these candidates give all their variations of what they would do to get America out of Iraq, it really left her uncertain about what to think.
There's so many different ideas. You don't know who to believe has the right solution. Who do you believe?
That's a tough one.
That's
I know.
The problem.
Do I understand, John, that she even told you she's flirting with the idea of voting for a Democrat?
Yeah, I would say flirting is the strongest way of putting it, and she probably won't. There's a lot of peer pressure that goes on among Republicans, and this is definitely a Republican household. But it does speak to the level of frustration with what has gone on in Iraq. And, I mean, Laurie said this is a ridiculous war. We should have never been there. She has a son in the military, as she and Jay do. And so this issue cuts very close to home.
Right. Well, you tell us your voters, the three that you sat with, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney didn't appeal to them. They felt he was a little too polished. But we do want to ask you in the couple minutes we have about Sunday when you sat with three undecided Democrats. What's your overarching takeaway from that as they watched the Democrats debate?
I think that all of them were a little bit surprised, some more than others, about the favorable impression that John Edwards made. I mean, because what they're looking for is someone who can make bold, strong statements and yet somehow hold out their hand to people in the other party. And they felt that they got that from John Edwards. They don't like Democrats who take a lot of risks and pussyfoot around the issues. John Edwards now, he's not in office. He's free to talk about a lot of things, and he does, and they liked it.
Huh. That's interesting. Does that reflect anywhere else? I mean, have there been polls showing that he made some increase after Sunday? Because we know that some of the polls have shown that Hillary Clinton's numbers actually went up, that Barack Obama didn't make as much of a dent in her appeal on Sunday night.
Well, you know, given the nature of my project, I don't really pay attention to the polls.
Oh,
as
and
such.
Listeners are saying good for you.
they probably are. And, you know, I'll tell you something. The folks in Exeter, they really like their process, like a lot of New Hampshire voters. They really want to go through the various steps of vetting the candidates and making up their mind at the end. And I think that a lot of New Hampshire voters think that way. I actually am rather mistrustful of the polls that I see right now. People give you an answer, but I don't necessarily think that they're going to stick with those answers.
That's John Greenberg of New Hampshire Public Radio. He's going to be following voters in Exeter, New Hampshire, keeping a close eye on that town throughout the primary season as they stubbornly, and good for them, go through the process, trying not to have outside influence on it. And John, we hope you come back and tell us more as it goes along.
Oh, it would be my pleasure.
Thanks so much. So before we go today, our critic at large, Ed Siegel, he's going to imagine what DJ Bob Dylan and soprano producer David Chase's iPods sound like. You're listening to Here and Now. The hit HBO series The Sopranos ends its run this Sunday night, and whatever happens, mob boss Tony Soprano won't be talking to his therapist about it. The therapy scenes between Lorraine Bracco as Dr. Melfi and Tony, played by James Gandolfini, were so admired by actual therapists that the American Psychoanalytical Association gave the show an award. Now, some members may want it back. On last week's episode, Dr. Melfi is at a dinner party with fellow therapists when one mentions a study claiming that violent criminals manipulate talk therapy. Then Dr. Melfi's own supervisor, Elliot, outs her star patient.
Soprano. Tony Soprano? He's your patient?
Oh, Jesus Christ, Elliot.
After dinner, Dr. Melfi fires Tony as her patient, convinced by the study that her work enables his violence. It turns out the study is real and was written by Drs. Samuel Yoshelson and Stanton Samenow. But is patient outing also real? Dr. Harvey Greenberg is a practicing psychiatrist. He's written about media. Dr. Greenberg, are your colleagues buzzing about all this?
There's a huge buzz. But as somebody once said, in order to be disillusioned, you have to have illusions in the first place. The illusion was that she was a great therapist, and this is the greatest therapy on television or movies.
You never bought that?
Never. I thought she made multiple errors. We don't have time to go into them.
Well, let me just bring up one that you've mentioned, that first of all, she even took on a patient knowing that they both knew that he wasn't in waste management. But, you know, having said that criticism of her, you also say she shouldn't have fired him.
She's got a real problem. Once you impose this kind of limitation where you agree with a patient and they agree with you that they're not going to talk about a major part of their lives and really what they do in depth, you've imposed a terrible barrier between the therapist and the patient. Honesty is the basis of what we do.
Well, but then she does finally fire him because she feels that he's using her, he's manipulating her, and she's learned this through her colleagues and the study. Some would say, watching the show off and on for years, that also maybe she hasn't any impact. He's still whacking people left and right.
I don't agree with that. She's under a lot of peer pressure. I think her supervision has been contaminated from the very beginning by her supervisor's insistence that she terminate therapy with him and not telling her how to go about doing that in an appropriate way. I think she's very confused, and I think that the way out of it is to do it by amputation. She is very cruel to him, and I think he's, interestingly, appalled by that, and he reads the fact that she's not really in touch with what she's doing and is acting unprofessionally. He reads that better than she does. He walks out. Here's this absolute monster who walks out with tears in his eyes.
One of the bloggers we've been reading, everybody's talking about this online, says, isn't this funny? As it turns out, maybe in this moment he has more integrity than
absolutely
the therapist, and then the therapist's therapist, Elliot, who, you know, is seeming more like a mob boss at that point.
And this that's a very good point. I believe that absolutely. Elliot really is vile when he actually enables everybody to talk about this under the aegis of this research, so that all has this sort of semi-professional ring, and then he manages absolutely to reveal Tony's identity, which is a total breach of professional ethics.
That's what we want to ask you. Does that happen?
I've heard of it happening, but it sure wouldn't happen in my office. Freud imposed the rule of abstinence. Basically, the idea of abstinence is you don't reveal, you don't go out with your patients, you don't do a lot of things, you don't wag your head, and, well, if I could tell you, blah, blah, blah. You don't do any of that. Everybody's been talking about how the show is going to end, okay? Here are the possibilities. The leading possibility is that Paulie Walnuts is going to have Tony whacked because he's been walking down both sides of the street with the New York mob on one hand and the Jersey mob on the other. My feeling is Tony could classically rat everybody out and go into witness protection. And here is the third thing. Melfi could see the error of her ways and call up Tony and apologize that she really shouldn't have abandoned him. That would be another thing.
And they start having an honest relationship as therapist and patient.
Yes, and then she calls the cops, puts him in jail, because after all, if he's ever going to get better, he has to fess up to being a monster.
Step number one.
Yeah.
Admit your whatever. Dr. Harvey Greenberg, he practices in New York City. Dr. Greenberg, thank you so much.
Okay, nice talking to you.
You too. Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
Bye.
After the break, the music of The Sopranos, here and now.
Oh.
Now, the question used to be, what albums would you take to a desert island? Well, now, the question is, if you could trade iPods with anyone on the earth, who would it be? A rock star? A film director like Martin Scorsese? Well, Hear Now critic at large Ed Siegel has been sampling some of his favorite artists, and he's come up with two whose wide-ranging tastes are both impeccable and unpredictable. Ed's here with us. Ed, who's at the top of your list?
Well, I hate to start out by plugging another radio show.
Oh, boy. But go ahead.
But the only other appointment radio I have besides Here and Now is Wednesday morning at 10 when I don't miss listening to this show.
Ernestine Anderson, keep an eye on Love on the Same Time Radio Hour.
That's great. That's Bob Dylan on his XM radio show. I mean, he sort of has down, doesn't he? When did this happen?
It happened about a year ago, and he plays 1 hour a week of the best country, rock, jazz, blues, pop, and even hip-hop and classical artists you'd ever want to hear, with even a poet and some household hints thrown in, too. Here's a sample of his music and his banter.
Yes, we stay away for a while, but we know in the end we'll invite them over again.
That was George Jones with Melvin Montgomery. A song from the swinging 60s. I don't mean the swinging 60s like Carnaby Street. I mean the swinging 60s. Like we have a party, and the men put all their car keys in a hat. The wives pick out a car key. You put on a Trini Lopez record, and everybody just swings. Now, I've never been to a party like that myself, but I hear those kind of things happen.
Okay, Bob Dylan, DJ. You know, why would he do this? He can't be doing it for money. So.
Right. Well, you know, I think that as you read Chronicles Volume 1, the first part of his autobiography, he talks about how he had a kind of mid-career funk. Mm-hmm. He was just playing all his music in a hard rock, rote kind of way. Then he started covering other people's music, and I think by doing that, he rediscovered his own muse. And that, in turn, I think, has led to his last three remarkable albums, where you can hear the influences of people like Muddy Waters and Johnny Cash.
And you say the range is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he played Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in a show about spring, and he played the Monkees, The Last Train to Clarksville, on a show about trains.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, that he was influenced by Johnny Cash. That's quite a line to draw from the Monkees to Johnny Cash.
Well, you know, somebody asked him what unified all the music that he played, and in an email, he reads emails on the show, and here was his response to that.
One thing every record on Theme Time Radio Hour has in common, no matter where they're from or how different the style of music, each and every one of them comes strict from the heart, and you can take that to the bank. Here at Theme Time Radio Hour, we believe in the same thing that Colonel Sanders believed in. He told everyone that worked for him, KISS, K-I-S-S, keep it simple, stupid.
Bob Dylan also dispensing, you know, the kind of thing that you hear in 12-step programs as well. He doesn't seem to... Does he play his own music?
No, I've never heard him play his own music, but he does pop up prominently on somebody else's iPod. David Chase, the producer of The Sopranos, has used music to underscore the lives of Tony and the gang in a really brilliant way. Some of it is music that underlines the lives of the characters, and some of it is music that Chase and music editor Catherine Dyack have chosen to illustrate the story or say something about the characters that they haven't said themselves. Mm-hmm. It's almost always recorded music, but in one case, Dylan came to him and said that he wanted to cover a Dean Martin song.
Return on a man, cara mia, te amo, solo tu, solo tu, solo tu, solo tu mio cuore.
Oh, do you remember the scene that
yeah.
in which Dylan covered a Dean Martin song for The Sopranos? What was the scene?
Tony was coming back to Carmella.
Right. Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, you know, Chase's musical tastes do seem as eclectic as Dylan's, now that I think about it, when you think of the show.
Uh-huh. And in the episode in which Tony killed Christopher, there was Roger Waters, Lucinda Williams, M. Ward, Lil Flip, The Pretenders, Duke Ellington, and Calexico.
I just have to say, I haven't been keeping up with my Sopranos. He kills Christopher? Oh, my God.
Oh, I'm sorry, Robin.
All right. Oh, my. Okay, well, we move on. So what does the music that Chase picks say about these characters?
In the case of Chase, it's both the razor's edge that these characters walk on, and also it's, I think it underscores their desire to get beyond their blood-drenched, machismo-laced lives. Those that great season-ending episode in which Uncle Junior sang a pop opera to a family gathering. Core, core ingrata, t'hai pigliato a vita mia, tutto è passato.
It also, you know, some might point an accusing finger at it and say it's the reason that we accept the violence from these people, because it softens them.
Well, that's right. Although I think that it shows the reason why we sympathize with them, but Chase also pulls the rug up from under us and really shows us how violent they are too.
When they kill Christopher, and with the finale of The Sopranos coming up, everybody's wondering if Tony is going to get it. Right. What do you think? What would you guess David Chase is going to play over the closing credits?
I should say that Chase once said that he could have scored the entire series to the music of Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, or Elvis Costello.
Huh.
So if he wanted to be really literal, he could end it with Dylan's It's All Over Now, Baby Blue.
The sky, too, is folding under you. And it's all over now, baby blue.
Or if he wanted to go back to what we were talking about in terms of Tony yearning for something different, how about Elvis Costello's What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding?
What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
But, you know, when you think about all the blood on Tony's hands, I think that this is the perfect song to go out on.
Good to meet you. Hope you get my name. Yeah. But what puzzled you is the nature of my game.
Well, we'll have to wait for the Sopranos season finale to see if there will be any sympathy for Tony Soprano. Ed, thank you so much for giving us your picks for downloading onto the iPod.
Thank you, Robin. My pleasure.
And for more about Bob Dylan and David Chase, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us now.